Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast. I'm Ollie Lum and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Matt Seddon. Look guys, it's episode 25. It's the one you've all been waiting for. We've got Chris Thompson on the podcast today. The guy needs no introduction, but let's remember he's a 2012 Olympian and of course, the winner of this year's UK Marathon Trials for the Tokyo Olympics. Enjoy.
Yeah, welcome back for another week, guys. Finally, we have the King of the Mara, comeback king, Tomo, all right? And look, I'm just going to leave you with his Insta bio. I run, but prefer racing. Sums him up, sums his Tokyo selection up. But look, we talked to him this week about a heap of stuff. I'll keep it short and simple, but there is so many life lessons in this podcast today. You know, Tomo does a great job of talking and, you know, we really get down and deep into his career, injuries, his support bubble, everything to why he is just so successful and has had such a long career, basically. And then obviously we talk about the exciting stuff, you know, Tokyo coming up, you know, how he's training, what he's up to. We talk about the race itself, everything like that as well. So look, enjoy the podcast. It's a long one. So track's coming. So maybe one last long run before the summer. Take care, guys.
Tomo, thanks for coming on. Welcome to the podcast. First of all, just from both of us, and I guess congratulations on booking your spot on the team.
Thank you.
What's it been like past, what, month or so?
It's a month today.
Yeah.
I realised that in my session this morning. I thought, wow. Crikey, it's 4 weeks today. It throws me as well every time because it was a Friday race rather than a weekend. So obviously we work off weekends, but it was a Friday morning, which was good as well because that meant I got to, well, I say enjoy my weekend. You wake up after a race and it's Saturday and you've got soccer Saturday, you've got all the fun, but my phone had gone crazy and I didn't get to bed till like stupid o'clock that night because by craziness, having a child has completely turned sleep and everything on its head. But man, I don't know. Every now and again, when I drift back to that day and I drift back to that week, I still get goosebumps thinking about it. I've had a long career, but you don't get into the sport and imagine you're going to have a moment like that because a lot of the time you're thinking about performance, but sometimes sport goes beyond performance. And that week did. It was it was a special moment, and it's quite cool that my boy gets family kind of represents something so special that week. But yeah, I'm still on cloud nine. Wherever cloud nine is, it's somewhere up there, but I'm up there.
I think this is it. Like every time it's his birthday swings around, you'll know that pretty much then you qualified for the Olympics. So I mean, on that note, like tell us a bit about your preparation going into the race. You were still, I mean, am I correct in saying you're about 2 minutes outside the standard or just under?
As in my time that I had that was in the window.
Yes. Yeah. In the window. Yeah.
So yeah, obviously my PB was inside the qualifying, but from years ago, but yeah, I was, so what was I 2:13 and change about 2:13 and a half. So yeah, about 2 minutes off at London in October. And that build up was a bit strange because, it was quite late in the day when it was confirmed it was going ahead. So there was a bit of indecision at that, because at that point races the restrictions had started to let up, but it was still very uncertain about what would happen. And I, like most athletes, was a little bit limbo through the kind of early summer last year. And it's difficult training when you're older, because when in those scenarios of training for the sake of training is a lot harder the older you get, because you've done it for so long. And so I needed a carrot. Carrot's a crap one because I like carrot doesn't get me out of bed. Like cheesecake or something. So I needed a cheesecake.
Yeah.
It all suddenly turned on its head that London not only was going ahead, but it was going to be a qualifying race as well. And so I came late to the party a bit when it came to training for that. And so preparation for that was fine, but it was very much, very much in third gear, I guess. And the way the race went and the way it gave me a lot of confidence that if I just move into fourth, fifth gear in preparation for this one, then I know I'm going to turn up in a lot better shape. And which is exactly what I did. I didn't try and do anything silly. My main number one goal was to be on the start line healthy, which I made difficult because I don't know if you guys read the article. I didn't talk about it a lot, but I broke my hand 9 weeks before the race, which I wouldn't recommend. But it was quite a bad injury, and I was just starting to get going in training, and I was just starting to see some nice sprouts of fitness and sessions coming through. And so, but because of that, it ended up being a bit of a stutter rather than an end to my ambition. I had to take a little bit of a gamble with getting back to training sooner than medically advised. But, you know, you don't make the Olympics through not taking a few risks or being a bit brave here or there. But the actual, once I got, I think it was about 7 weeks before the race, it was one of the smoothest kind of preps I've had. I mean, it had its challenges with regards having a wife that could drop at any point. We'd moved house. There was a lot of things going on, but I don't know what it was, but I just entered this world of calmness and I took a lot of things in my stride and I kind of almost went into this, all that pent upness for the last year of uncertainty, what's going on, what am I training for or not. It was like I entered this bubble of just calm, right, this is it now, 7 weeks, and I just training each week, just every session I was just getting better and better. And usually in a marathon you're kind of yo-yoing a bit, some days are good, some days are bad, and I just had this refreshed kind of mindset of I was just enjoying my running, enjoying the fact that I had a real purpose to what I was doing, enjoying the fact I was going to be a dad soon. That was putting a pep in my step. And I put together some of the best stuff I've done in terms of marathon prep across all marathon build-ups, to the point where myself and my coach just said, look, we just need to keep ourselves to ourselves because things are, like any marathon, you can train really well for it and it go terribly. You can train terribly for a marathon and it go well. So I'm fully aware that training, the fact that training was going well didn't get us a ticket to on the plane. So yeah, it wasn't a long period of wow training, but I got a really nice, short, sharp period of like loveliness, which, and I think that kind of mentally and physically carried me through that week leading into the race when just carnage hit with Theo arriving, sleep, not getting a huge amount of sleep. But I was so healthy and so fit before it, I think I just rode that wave. And I just managed to get there. But it was close. close, because I was on that day, I was very head tired. I was exhausted, but physically, I was possibly about as prepared as I could be, despite a lot of things that had happened.
Wow. It's interesting you say about sort of getting out of bed, because do you think had it not been in Olympic trials, had it not been the Olympics, you would have, like you said, you would have had your baby boy on during the week and maybe the fatigue would have caught up with you and you would have just thought, meh, come race day. And as well, like in training, because it was the Olympics, you just had that little motivation. As someone who's had a career like yours and you've already been to the Olympics, it is hard to, you know, keep getting motivated, isn't it?
It is hard, because I think as well, I'm 40 now. I turned 40 last weekend. Mm. So, you know, I'm not a spring chicken I'm not necessarily looking at PBs or performances that are going to better, you know, get in better shape than I have historically. But like you say, you've got to find what puts that fire in your belly, what's going to make me want to get out the door. And I think, like you say, like there's always been this one of the things in my, I mean, as you get close towards the end of your career, I think you reflect and you, there's a part of you that starts regretting and feeling a bit like, I didn't do this, I didn't do that, I didn't run faster. And I've had a few conversations with ex-athletes. And I say ex, you're never an ex-athlete. You just stop doing it full time, I guess, is a better way of saying it. But a lot of athletes, when you talk to them, and athletes who are highly successful and you look at and go, I'd love your career, but they still always kind of will, there's this chip of something that they're not totally happy with. And that made me think, well, you know what, I'm gonna have to accept that there will be things I'm not totally happy with. There's gonna be things that will grind on me, that I should have run faster here, I should have done this, should have done that. And so that was a big moment 2 or 3 years ago where I started going, well, what's gonna make me excited to, like you say, get out the door and do this? And I think making a second Olympics, because 2012 obviously didn't go too well for me, but a big part of that was because I wasn't trying to make the team, I was trying to win a medal. I mean I'm not going to shy away, I was training like I thought I had the ability to medal that in the 10K at 2012. Rightly or wrongly, that's how I approached it. And obviously, when you do that, things go wrong, and I got pretty badly injured, and I nearly didn't make the start line. And that left me with a feeling of, and I could go into more detail about the 2012 Olympics, and I have done in the past, but it's long-winded. But in a nutshell, I felt a bit like an imposter. I felt like when you have that kind of ruthless mindset, you feel like there's always that part of you that feels like you're not good enough, and that's what part of what drives you. And there was always this thing in the back of my mind, I didn't earn that Olympic spot. And that's sounds silly, but that's a good thing as well, because that's drives you. And I think this 2016, I got injured and I wasn't able to make the team. And I think this kind of represented an opportunity to, from an Olympic standpoint, to kind of justify making a second Olympics, justifying myself as an Olympian a little bit. Mm. Sounds strange to say, but it was a real thing that I wanted to do. And I think that's part of why I got into this real zone. Once it got close to, I came alive. I became, everything was just metronomic. I just, every experience I drew upon was just, there was just this calmness. And in the race, I was tired. And you're right, there were probably some moments early on that if it wasn't the Olympic trials, I might have made some slightly different decisions. But I mean, there were times in there where I was feeling like, Is this worth me pushing to the end when I could stop and do another race because I'd recover quicker? But this is the Olympic trials. You don't do that. And I think once I'd caught the group, after obviously I fell back by 35 seconds, when I caught the group, I don't think I've ever had a feeling quite like in a race of just complete control. And I was so in control of my body, my mind and everything for those last 4 miles.
Wow.
I was so confident and secure in what I was doing, which in a marathon is weird because in a marathon you should be knackered. But that was pure and utter Olympic desire. Everything, all the things I've just talked about, just it was that I'm doing this. And there was just all that adrenaline, everything that had gone through me that week with Theo being born, all the challenges, everything that had gone on. There was just this sporting moment of no one's taking this away from me now. But obviously I had to earn it to get to that point, because you don't win a marathon the first 6 miles. You don't win it in the first 13 miles. And I had to go through some demons to get to those 4 miles. But once I was there, it wasn't being taken away from me because I just entered this really strange calmness. And I turned a corner, I think it was a mile and a half to go. And I went to look around me just to check on the situation, not through fear, just through just just, it's quite instinctive sometimes if you're at the front of a race to kind of just look. And I turned and my hamstring nearly cramped. And I went, and it was like a sudden, whoa, calm down. You haven't finished yet. Finish the job off. And that was kind of, it was almost like a virtual slap in the face from my wife of, don't F this up now. You've come this far. And I just checked back a bit because I knew I was inside the time quite comfortably at that point. I was actually quite lucky because my coach had sent me the splits for what the qualifying time was to write on my hand just in case I needed them. And I completely forgot. And last minute before the race, I was like, oh, I haven't written the splits down. I quickly wrote them down. They were pretty smudged. So for the last couple of, I think it was, 35 and 40K splits, I luckily had them. And that was why I knew I was in, and along with Mike telling me. But it was a real kind of, slap in the face to kind of go, just don't get misplaced, complacent. I think that's the right word. And bring it home. But it was, it was a very, the Olympics and that allure of the Olympics can do incredible things. And it's, I guess, and in some ways, and I'm just thinking this now, it's almost like I felt that Olympic power a little bit in that race in the last 4 miles, because exactly as you're saying, would I have felt that if it was a standalone race and there was nothing else on the line, it was just a victory? I can't see it myself. I think what it represented, everything about it, Theo, everything was, it was just the perfect storm for me. So, yeah.
Wow. It's amazing you talk about the sort of mental state you were in, you know, due to like the occasion and just everything going on at the time as well. Do you worry about ever reaching that sort of mental state again? So like, obviously Tokyo is on the horizon. Yeah. Do you worry, geez, how am I going to sort of get into that zone again? Or I guess you can't think like that too much, can you?
Well, I don't think it's a case of it's, I think if you speak to any athlete that of any standard, they'll talk about that one race or that one moment where they felt like they were on floating on air.
Yeah.
And I think we all accept that it's not something you search for. It's just something that just comes to you. And I certainly wouldn't say I would worry about, because I mean, I've run some of my best races and I've just hurt from start to finish. So it's good races come in all shapes and sizes and all kinds of feelings. And I think I've gotten used to having to work very hard to get what I've got. Yeah. And so, you know, I think what I feel very lucky about in that moment is not can I reproduce that feeling? I think of feeling that empowered. I think it's more a case of going, you know what? It was, as my coach said it to me, and I agree. I think it's the closest. I felt like I had this kind of running, or should we say, almost like a career kind of utopian feeling of contentment that day, because it was a real team effort with my family and support team, because I'm not lottery funded. I'm not on the in crowd anymore. I'm on my own little island with Tom, my chiro, Gemma, my massage and physio, Alan, my coach. We're our own little island doing our thing. Scott, training partner, and it's lovely to be able to almost share that with them and be. And we just had that moment of, it was worth the fight. Because I tell you that, because I coach as well, and it's difficult because the athlete I coach, he's a hardworking lad, and you just wish the best for them, because he doesn't get much support, and you think, God, no. You deserve good things. This sport doesn't give people that deserve things what they deserve. That's the harsh thing about it. It's ruthless. And I think in a lot of ways, like I think a lot of my support team felt like I deserved a moment like that, but I was never going to get it unless I managed to find a way. And I think that's why I feel very lucky, because there's other athletes out there working just as hard, getting over just as many challenges as I have, and they deserve everything. But sometimes you just don't quite get the moment. So it's, it, you know, the fact I've come on, gone on this long, I think that day kind of made me feel like, yeah, that was worth fighting. That was worth carrying on, because really and truthfully, I probably should have stopped years ago. not just because I'm older, but probably because people are bored of me turning up all the time. Is he on the start list again? Would he just go away?
it's interesting. You mentioned that moment, and for me, and I guess probably a lot of people watching, the moment you cross the line, like the passion you see. What was that like? You've mentioned kind of the calmness, but was it almost like I can let it all out now? Like once you kind of broke the tape, it was. Mm-hmm. Anyone who's listening, if you haven't seen the video, go and watch the video of it, because it's one of the best finishes to a race I've witnessed. This kind of you can't. I think I've watched it on repeat for 10 minutes or so. But like it's crazy. Like the passion, like you see it and listen to you talk about it now. It's real. Like you kind of
I bottled up. I've never bottled up so much emotion in all my life to get through that day. And I was struggling the warm up. I was really struggling on the warm up to feel any sort of readiness. I felt wobbly. I felt emotionally drained already. And I was the thing is, I'm an older athlete, so I know warm ups are not there for you to think that defines your race in how you feel. It's trying to do is get your heart rate up, get the blood flow, get your body ready to race. Especially in a marathon, part of the warm-up is the start first couple of miles of a marathon. So you continue in that warm-up into the marathon, unlike other races. So but I felt horrendous. But I knew I was fit, and I knew a lot of it was mental. The amount of I've not had, so I don't listen to music before a race, because from a young age I realized that music was making me feel like I was it was getting me too pumped, too amped.
Yeah.
And, I felt like I was getting ready for a 100-meter sprint, which I wasn't. I was a distance runner, and you need to be ready for the last couple of laps of a 5K, not for the first two. And I quickly realized that I need to stop putting too much stimulus into me. And so I took music out of my warm-up, and it's something I don't, it just gets me, it can get me too amped. And this time there was a lot of things going on around me in before this race that I thought I need to put some music in to distract me. And as soon as I put it on, I think it was like a really upbeat, fast, like it wasn't drum and bass, but it was some kind of like song that would actually is fitting in a nightclub. And that was making me feel emotional about Theo. And I thought, how am I linking these two? Cause I just couldn't distract myself from things. So I thought, just turn it off. Everything was making me choke up. And it was like, I need to remove. So I literally went to the toilet probably 5 or 6 times. Half of them, I probably didn't even pee. I was just trying to get up, move, trying to just distract myself. I even went on an extended warm-up again to try and add things to do. I'm losing my train of thought a little bit. Apologies. But then the finish line. And then, as the race went on, and again, because I lost ground and because of the circumstances, the way the race panned out, that just made it even more like I've lost it, I've got it. I myself, after an hour and 20, hour and a half, was watching my Olympics go. Like, because I'm one of those stubborn people that until it's gone, I'll keep fighting. I just will fight to the bitter end. I'm really, really stubborn like that. And it's like, I almost needed to run that race. I needed to run that race as much to know I didn't do it as much as I was trying to do it. because I couldn't have sat at home and watched that race and wonder. I had to train for it. I had to see it through. And the fact that I thought I'd gone, and then in the space of 10 minutes was like, I'm doing this. That in itself, I had to like calm myself down. So when I came around that final bend and saw the tape, saw I was in it, I said it on another podcast. My only regret is I didn't take the full 30 seconds I had in the bag to save it. Honestly, I just lost it. I absolutely lost it in my head. Yeah. And I forgot, as far as I was aware, no one was there. I was just my head exploded. It just exploded. I exploded internally. I was screaming. If people went there, I'd have gone in the pond. I seriously would have jumped in. Yeah. I had to take myself off to the side, and someone came up to me and said, "Your finish has gone viral." And I thought, I just hadn't come back down to earth because I was just off somewhere. I was just completely in another world of like, give me a sec. Holding. It's just, I can't describe it. That was my Olympic gold medal. Even though I haven't won a gold medal, it was like, it just felt that powerful to me. I just can't imagine. It's the closest it was my sporting utopian moment. And I just lost it, completely lost it. And just,
It looked like that. It looked like a career of just, I don't know, it just looked like your whole career in one moment, basically.
That's a good way of saying it. I'm going to use that. Thanks very much for that. Because that's the thing. It's when you, because I've been doing this sport for 26 years.
Wow.
And that makes me feel very old just saying that. But it's how do you box that? How do you in that moment, you can't rationalize it in that moment other than through yelling, screaming, and just going mental. You can't, there's no, even now I can't rationalize it in any other way than just welling up because you can't rationalize it. It's just the number of times I've sat in the car, it's raining outside going, I don't want to do this. I'm by myself. Just, I know my foot's going to hurt and I don't want to get out of the car, but you drag yourself out to do it. The number of times you do that. I mean, I can count on one hand how many enjoyable moments in training there's been over the last 6 years because I haven't had pain. It's so few and far between and you keep coming back for more. And I don't know what it is. There's something in the back of my mind that just wouldn't let me quit. I'm so glad he didn't let me. I don't know where he is now. He's probably gone, my work is done, and he's probably buggered off. But like something in the back of my head wouldn't let me stop, and I'm so glad he didn't.
Yeah. I mean, let's talk about like the course judgment and the tactics. So obviously, like at 13 miles, you were halfway. You were 35 seconds down, and it all happened. I mean, maybe it didn't happen obviously from your perspective, but us watching it happened so quickly. One minute you weren't in shot, the next you were with them or even ahead of them. So, I mean, I read somewhere as well, like after the race, you'd interestingly said you did a lap. You know, you'd negotiated the corners and you thought, yeah, these guys, you trusted that they wouldn't be able to keep that pace up. So was it like a conscious decision for you to back off, or were you just sort of like, I need to just run my own race, and if they go quicker, accept that, you know, they're going to beat me today?
No, yeah, I didn't. It wasn't a case of I thought they couldn't keep it up, because you got to bear in mind, like, the Dowie's a 2.9 runner,
yeah,
and capable of quicker. Ben Connor is a classy runner, and I'd still say he's very well. Both Dowie and Ben are still young when it comes to marathon running, so they're going to keep getting quicker. So, Mo was his clearly. I mean, I'd heard some good things about that he was a threat as well. And so he was an unknown. But in terms of, for me, after a couple of laps, because it's been mentioned, but the twisty bit of the course up to the top was wind in your face. And then you turned back for the straight bit and it was a bit more generous. So you had the loop became very clear to me that it was very much a hard work and then you can sort of
coast
off. And being in a group and trying to negotiate those corners and work hard, it was zapping for me. And it was just a little bit too uncomfortable for me. And I had to check back because I knew I would not have sustained that for a marathon at that point in time. I think it was a 15-12 5K. The fastest 5K was in the first or second 5K, which was part of the reason I had to check back, because these guys were clicking along nicely and it was just pinching me. But when I decided to ease and back into my own little world, I didn't deliberately allow a gap to appear. I just didn't fight it. And I was just watching the gap slowly open. And I, rather than getting agitated, I just allowed it to do what it naturally, organically do what it was going to do. But it was very slow. It was a very slow drip. So it went from half an hour to halfway. It opened up by, I think it was 15 seconds. Which is slow. I mean, over the course of half an hour, that's
6 miles. Yeah.
You know, that's like half a second every minute. If I'm doing the math. No, hang on. Am I doing that right? No. Anyway,
it's 2 seconds a mile or so. Yeah.
It's really, really slow. And then again, that gap then from an hour to an hour and a half doubled again. But again, it was just a slow kind of happen. But they didn't look like they were slowing down. They look good from where I could see. I never run with a watch as well. It's irritating to watch people race with a watch because you think, well, there's enough clocks out there.
Yeah.
But I wasn't certain where the clocks would be and what was going on with the course. So I wore it more because I thought there might be a scenario like I was going to be in where I'd be in my own world. And there wasn't going to be that. I knew there wasn't going to be a car. It would be a bike. And so I needed it because I thought, I don't know I'm going to visually be able to see. And I was just clocking what the gap was. And it was just getting to the point. It got to about 20 seconds and I stopped looking because I thought, this is getting big. And I thought, I knew I was still inside the course, the qualifying time. And so that's what I was feeding off. But when you've got three athletes away and you need two of them to come back, and you know that they're all capable of running. For all I knew, they were holding back. I didn't know if they were holding back. I didn't know what was going on, but I just know they were all athletes that it wasn't a shock to me that they were in front. You know, it wasn't like, I wasn't looking at them going, oh, you know, not for a second did I think they've overcooked it, because it was impossible to know. All I knew is I couldn't sustain it. There was two things that, because there was a lot of negative stuff coming at me thinking, oh God, this gap's getting big. There was two things that still had to happen in the race, which I was trying to keep an open mind to. One was once you get to 20, 21 miles in a marathon, you find out how well you've kind of paced yourself. And that can change a race very quickly. And two, the pacemaker hadn't dropped out. And once the pacemaker drops out, in my mind, I thought, well, you've got three athletes. One of them doesn't care what time you run. So, you know, Ben Connor if the pacemaker drops out, he is not going to keep the pace going. All he cares about is being top two. Mo had, the way he conducted himself was very much, he'll sit on whatever's going on. He didn't look like he was someone who was going to push anything. I don't know the lad really well, but the way he had maneuvered himself, I thought, so the only athlete I could see wanting to keep the pace going or would try to is Dowie. Then you're going, right, okay, well, when the pacemaker drops out, it's up to Dowie to keep it going. And if he can't, I don't know what the other two will do, but it looks like they would just leave it. So it then came down to where I don't have to worry about if this was a time trial or if it was any one of them was feeling good, they'd have kept it going. But this isn't. This is a championship race. Ben had a very particular scenario he needed. And so the dynamics were not quite the same. But before Callum dropped out, I turned a corner and I saw a gap had appeared. And I thought, okay. Well, that wouldn't be there if they were feeling good.
Yeah.
And it was the first time, I don't know when exactly it was, but it was the first time I got a positive of, okay, they are feeling something here. It was the first time, and I thought, because I'd been in my own world, because there was no way I was closing that gap. If they'd have sustained at that pace, I wasn't catching them, because they would have run 2:10 flat, I think. And I wasn't going to close down. Yeah. So I was running what I could run, and I needed them to slow. And that was the first time I thought, okay. And then, this was just by chance. It wasn't any other, because Callum and Jake had done a great job pacing. Fantastic. They really did a great job pacing. And Callum just happened this way, that he dropped out on the hardest bit of the course. So when he dropped, it went from a pacemaker offering a pace and a carrot or cheesecake for the guys to follow. And suddenly Dowie needed to push the pace into the wind. And so he's gone from shelter, someone helping him, to suddenly do it yourself. And you've got finding that rhythm again, locking back into that rhythm is tough, especially at that point. And it was just the way that all materialized. But for me, I was already in a rhythm. I was already locked in. So I didn't change gear. I just sustained. And for them guys, they almost spent 5-10 minutes trying to find a new rhythm. And then it just flipped. And then once I got onto the back of them, because I'd need to look back on it, but I reckon that 30 seconds closed within.
Oh, it was crazy. Yeah.
It must have been a mile and a half, maybe even less than that. It might even have been over. It could have been over a mile. It could have been that quick, because it was over the tough part.
We just had an interview with Hawkins, and by the time it came back, it was the race was a completely different ball game.
Yeah.
So
I think even the commentators were a bit confused.
Yeah.
The commentators sort of were scratching that. I think Mara was a bit like, has he been lapped?
Yeah.
Like, literally, I think a few people were getting a bit confused. It was funny to look back at the race. I never watched my races back, but I watched this back because my boy was up. Kept me up to 2:30 that night, and I thought I'll watch it. And it was surreal because I knew what I was looking in the background. You can just see me in the background, sort of showing, appearing a little bit, sort of slowly coming at it, and then suddenly getting on top of them. But yeah, I mean, bless them. I think for a bit they were just hoping that I hadn't. That they hadn't gone the wrong way or something had happened. Yeah. I think the commentators were going, oh God, what they were trying to process what had gone on.
So when you caught up with them, you just went straight past them. Was there a part of you which was like just to relax and use them at all? Or was it just always, because they do say like if you go past someone, you need to go past them quick, right? To sort of kill them off. But it's easier said than done in a marathon because you'd run so long on your own.
Mm.
I wondered if you would just like sit on them for a little bit, you know?
Yeah, it was a thought process. So I had a very once because one when I was catching them, I was starting to get nervous. I was starting to get a little bit, my legs were going a bit jelly of like, oh my God, I'm back in the race. And so I was having to calm myself down a little bit to kind of find myself a little bit because I was feeling a bit jelly. But because I closed them so quickly, I didn't have much time to kind of get myself together, and I was only about 20-30 seconds before I caught them. My mind switched to right, you're catching them, what are you doing about it? And obviously, like you said, I had two choices: do I sit and just enter their rhythm, or do I go past them pretty hard, or do I have another idea? And in that kind of short time frame, I dismissed the sitting with them because in a marathon, I find that there's a delicate line between feeling good and crap. Mm-hmm. And you don't want to affect that line. You almost want to, you're trying to keep the rhythm and everything around you, especially at that point, you want to keep feeling good. And so you don't want to alter that too much, whether that's even if that means slowing down could be a negative. So I thought I dismissed that straight away. I went, no, I'm not slowing down. But then I thought, well, if I go past them slowly in my rhythm, then, and if they're feeling all right, I then become cannon fodder, and I have no information. And I thought, right, I need two things here. I need one, I need to go past them, but two, I need some information. I need to find out where I stand, because I didn't know. I hadn't been running for them for the last hour. So I had no information to know if they felt good, why they slowed down or anything. I had no idea. And we were all still within the time. So I made the decision to go past them hard. So I deliberately, with about 5 meters behind them, picked up the pace to surge. And I thought, right, I'll surge past them, give it 30 seconds, 40 seconds, whatever, and see how they respond, and then settle back into my rhythm and just get some information and see. And I didn't, you know, in a dream scenario, none of them go with you. Worst case scenario, they all go with you and you're like, oh crap, they all feel amazing. So I did it, and once I knew, I could hear a couple of them go with, but they didn't go with me in a way of they didn't suggest to me that they were totally okay. They kind of, it was a lethargic kind of come with me. And I took a check back and I looked behind, and Dowie had, unfortunately for him, he came off pretty quick, and then it was just Ben and Mo. And at that point I thought, right, well, they've come with you. You're obviously, it's going to take more effort than I'd like to get rid of them at this point. So I thought, right, just enter my own, go back into my rhythm. I've done my job. I've got a little bit of information. They didn't particularly enjoy that, but they've still come with me all the same. And we've still got another five miles to go at this point. So a lot can go wrong for me still here. And that's when I went back into a rhythm that I liked and let them do what they need to do. And they were, and then I just started to try and read them. I just tried to like work out where I stood, because we were still enough in the time that I had wiggle room to work things out and not just worry about the time. I could enter a race mode knowing we were still comfortably inside the time. Which helped. Like if we'd fallen behind the time at this point, I'd have had to just go.
Yeah.
And that could have really messed things up. But because the pacemakers had done a great job and the way the race had panned out, it gave me the opportunity to kind of suss out what was going on and use a bit of my race brain, which made a difference, because I used the next mile almost to catch my breath a bit and settle myself down a little bit. And that's when we went back into the tough bit of the course. So we hit the bottom of the course where the drink station was up to the top. And it was through that section that's when I did the damage. Yeah. Because that's when I kept the rhythm honest, but I didn't want them off. I was almost like trying, usually when the wind's there, you're trying to sit in behind, but I thought, yeah, into my rhythm. And I was crying out in my head, come with me. Just keep coming with me. Because I knew once I got to the top and I took the handbrake off, if they were still able to go with me, then it's going to be a race. But I needed them to sort of keep fighting through the tough section just to give me the best chance possible to get a gap. And once I got to the top and they were still with me, and I just took the handbrake off on the corner to come to do the straight shot back, the gap opened quickly. And that's when it was, then I was just in don't cramp mode. Just, you know, just get to the end. But that whole little section was just a real moment of, I keep using boxing analogies, but I almost feel like I was like in a boxing ring, and suddenly that I couldn't hear any crowd. I could have, you know, all I could hear was myself and the other fighter, and just this complete calmness of control of the decisions. I was making clear decisions, clear tactical assessment of everything. It was just this calmness was going through my head of what I needed to do. And like I was saying about, it was just a very weird moment of clarity. And I can only imagine it was just this this moment of this is not coming. This is not slipping from me now. There's only been one other moment in my career where I hit a moment of I've come this far. There is no way I'm losing this now. Was when I won my silver medal in Barcelona in 2010. And I was second behind Mo, and I ran a really poor race actually. When I looked back,
that was so close as well, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I entered the home straight of that race, mm-hmm. and I was in, well, I was third, but with fourth breathing down my neck. Mm-hmm. And I remember turning the corner and going, this is years in the making. And I finally got myself in this position to win a medal at this event and everything. And I just lit. It wasn't quite the same emotion, but it was I'm flipping winning a medal here. I am not losing this now. And I just remember just hitting just pumping everything. Every message Mark Rowland, my coach, had ever given me, everything went through my head. Like a million thoughts were going through my head in the space of a split second of what I needed to do to get that medal. And that 100 meters, I was just in this
you were just all guns
clarity, going. Clarity of thought process. And I was obviously, I got the second, I got the silver medal. Mo was already away and gone, but I beat the other two lads. And this marathon, just the clarity of thought I had was strange. But again, I can only think of two moments I've had in sport where I've felt like that, of just clear, concise thinking and being in control of myself, which again, it's a marathon. I think that clarity was just contributed by everything that had happened. It was just like, just this, it's that fight or flight. We're human, we're tuned to, like, you know, keep in reserve just that little bit. If it's like my coach says, there's always that little bit reserve in case you're chased by a tiger. from back in the day, it's like, you know, you've always, there's that little bit, and it was almost like my brain just had that, just found another level of clarity just to get the job done. But yeah,
it's fascinating to hear you talk about the mental side of racing and running so much. I think a lot of athletes just rely on like their fitness and their coaching and their preparation, but you've just discussed in like such depth the all the different emotions which can happen during a 2-hour marathon, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's all those things you mentioned contribute to that day of getting it done. But it's, I can only imagine that even in a 1500 meters, when I think of these people that have won Olympic gold medals in the 1500 meters, I'm sure all that hard work, everything that's gone into it, and they just get that moment of clarity in those last 300, 400 of just like, have you seen Kelly Holmes's 2004 1500 meter final when she, with 150 to go, or it's more like 120, she was lying in about fifth and she started looking around her like this because she knew she'd won it. She was in a complete control. She'd won the 800. And she felt that good. And it's like, she literally was just looking over her shoulder and got, right, I think I'll go now. And it's, you know, again, I didn't win the Olympics, but in my own little world, that I, it was special for me anyway. So
it's just like in a marathon, you just have so much more time to think about these things. Like you say, I think you will, in track races, sometimes it's hard to even allow negative thoughts to come into your brain because you're just so focused and they're over and done with quite quickly, you know. But in a marathon, I feel like you have so much time to just keep asking yourself, how am I feeling, you know. And it's just, it's funny to see like you battle that through the race, you know. You mentioned on it,
it's like if you get in a car and you've got a 4-hour journey and you ask someone to describe that journey, it's like so many chunks of it, just you can't remember. But there'll be key moments of parts of that journey that you will remember. Just keep, you know, little moments of things, and it's a bit like that in a marathon. There were so many moments through that race, but there was between half an hour and an hour and a half of that race for an hour, I was just in this very, in some ways, a bit of a depressing bubble when you were just managing it for an hour. Mm-hmm. And then from an hour and a half to for the last 40 minutes, it was just carnage. And yeah, just like, you're suddenly like, you're nearly there. But marathon running, like you say, there's such large chunks where you've just got to accept that you've almost got to just accept you're on a car journey and need to get bored. You need to get bored and just accept being bored and just keep doing the simple things, which is putting one leg over sounds a bit rude. Keep putting your leg over, take it as you want. And keep getting your drinks, doing your things, doing the things that you've trained, and just keep doing the boring things until you enter the race. Because a marathon, as we all know, is like, you don't win a race in the first, yeah, you don't win it until the final stages. And I think I'm not going to pretend I'm some kind of marathon guru, because I'm not, and I don't know if anyone ever really truly, the closest we got to someone who is incredible is Kipchoge. But is that because, is he a better racer or is he just a better marathon runner?
Yeah,
you know, it's two different things. And Callum in the last couple of world championships has shown himself to be potentially a phenomenal marathon racer. Mm-hmm. And really in tune with themselves. But you're always learning. I mean, every discipline I've ever done in my career, I look back and think of things I could have done better. And I'm sure with this marathon running, that, I mean, that race, I couldn't have run much better, but there's no guarantees that I'll run another marathon that well again. And I'll just fumble my way through it. I don't know, but it's the beauty of running, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Spot on.
So let's, you've mentioned like the emotion of the race a lot. And one thing about the race though was that it qualified you for the biggest race of them all. So at what point do you almost switch off the emotion or kind of change your focus towards the summer? Has that happened already? What's your preparation and kind of plans going into this summer in Tokyo?
I'm trying to drip feed back into reality now. Like I said, I did a session this morning, and I'm trying to. The thing now is I've got, obviously now we've got a young family. It's that's going to be a massive consumption for me physically and mentally. I mean, like, that's part of the reason, as you know, I was late coming on here because Theo needed feeding. So. So there are, that's, if I reminisce and look back, the emotion of it is still there. But I think on a daily basis, myself and Gemma, my wife, and Theo, we're trying to find our own way into a routine where we can all function as a family. And my routine needs to involve training in some capacity. So we're still ironing that out. I'm getting back going, and I've still got, what is it? 15 weeks to the marathon as of Sunday. But how, I mean, we need to get him a passport and things. It'd be good to, if we can go away, that he can come with us. So we're still working out how it's going to look and what the prep, but all I can do at the moment is I need to get myself back up to speed and into some sort of routine with training as best I can. So that's all I can do at the moment, is focus on that. But hopefully over the next month, I'll have an idea of where I can put myself, the details of to get ready. Because the other thing as well is, as we know, an Olympic marathon is not a marathon as such. It's a race. It could be anything. It could be any form of a race. And so I need to have a real think with my coach about what tool set do I need to take with me. You know, if it was a big city marathon, they're the easiest things to train for, because mm-hmm. you just got to be ready to run your socks off. This is slightly different. So I need to figure out if I need to be as fit as I would be for a big city, or whether I need to think about other little things. And so, yeah, we're still ironing out that, but I'm still trying to get my feet on the ground, because, I mean, I'm talking to you guys. I've done a lot of different interviews. I mean, I've, I'm running a marathon, but I've been talking marathon. I mean, I don't shut up. That's my problem. As you've noticed, my short answers for you is probably a 20-minute podcast, and I've just probably ruined it for you. I apologize, but it's, yeah, I think, like you say, at some point I've got to, I am switching on the game face. I am switching, but it's finding a new way of life. This is completely alien to me. I've got a small child who, you know, I've never been a dad before. I've never operated as an athlete with a small child before. So it's all new and fresh, and I'm just got to learn a new way of doing things. It's other athletes have done it before. Obviously it's a lot harder for females to do it because they actually do a bit more work when it comes to a birth than I've had to. All I had to do was like stand there and mop a brow. So I can't profess that to have any excuses like that. But it's, you know, I've seen enough females have children and come back and have fantastic careers. So I feel like I have good role models in that sense.
Definitely. Yeah, it's almost like uncharted territory, isn't it? Because you just, like I say, juggling the new family.
Yeah. And he's a cool little kid as well. I play little games. Like, he's great as well because Gemma hates it. I just put him, stand him up and just see if he can take his weight. He can hold himself up.
You've got him squatting already.
Well, that's the thing. Every time I say down and he just looks at me, I'm like, come on, squat down. He's like, he's not even 5 weeks. He's 4 and a bit weeks. And he's, I'm trying to get him to grip things as well for golf clubs and stuff. It's great fun. It's hilarious. He just looks at me as if to say, Dad, what? Like, give me a break. Let me grow up a little bit. No, come on. Goodness. I want to play chess. Let's go, Theo. Come on.
So I get something to like some athletes, like I think I remember like Nick Willis saying like it, or Chris O'Hare as well, like it almost changed and they almost became better because it was just something, you know, their mind was on the kid. They weren't stressing out about sessions so much, you know.
Yeah, so, could do. We'll see. I mean, I certainly at the moment can't say that he's helped because I'm exhausted. That I haven't got to that point yet. But I'm. Some athletes function better with distraction. Some, I mean, I historically work much better when I'm a single tracked mind kind of person. I don't like distractions, and so I will have to accept that I have to be adaptable. But we'll see. Like, yeah, Chris has done it. Nick, there's lots of athletes that have, like Ben Bruce, Steph, good friends of mine. I mean, it's not unusual. I mean, my coach Mark Rowland. I can't remember if Suzanne was alive when Mark won his Olympic bronze in 1988. So, you know, I certainly can't use an excuse like that on him. Get on with it, mate. Get on with it.
Back in my day.
In my day, I worked in the factories, then went for a run, then fed the kid, then did a million press-ups. What are you doing? Get on with it.
Let's talk about let's backtrack a little bit and just talk about like your early career, getting into the sport. You know, I guess when you were running on the track all those years ago and, you know, at uni and then you went to like the Oregon Track Club, did you ever envisage stepping up to the marathon? And it'd be interesting to see like how different training and stuff was as a sort of 5K, 10K guy and at that age to what it is now.
The first question was, did I envision doing a marathon when I was
I guess 20? Start there. Yeah.
No. I, when I was a kid, I never envisioned a career in running. So when I was young, all I cared about was doing sport, just anything. I just love sport. I did everything. I did gymnastics, judo, cricket, football, tennis, badminton, everything. I just loved sport. I sort of found running through my PE teacher thought that me and a couple of other guys showed potential to do it outside of the school. And I played football outside of school. I did a lot of stuff. All those sports I said, I played outside of school. So athletics was the athletics stuck because of friendships. I made some really good friends at the Aldershot Farnham and District Club, which I still belong to. And I just never thought about tomorrow. All I cared about was the friendships and performing the best I could in whatever sport I was doing. You know, if I played cricket, I wanted to get the most runs. If I, you know, if any sport, I just wanted to be as good as I could be at it. So running was no different. I wanted to be as good as I could, but I didn't think about why or what that would do for me. But running, obviously, I had more success in other sports, which, and the friendships, and it kind of stuck a little bit more than anything else. And I remember my coach at the time, Mick Woods, he worked for BT. And in the newsletter, he'd said he thought I could be an Olympian one day. And this sounds really silly to say this now, but I thought, what's he talking about? No, I couldn't. Because I was precocious in terms of I didn't have any fear of anyone else. I just loved running hard and I loved winning things, but I wasn't looking at like other athletes and seeing the careers ahead and think I could do this, that, and the other. I like watching London Marathon and stuff, but I never envisioned myself being that person. And then and even when I went to uni, I went to Loughborough University again so that I could keep training, but again there was still no I can have a career out of this. And I think I took each year as it came, and just organically it became I'm good enough now to potentially make an Olympic team. And it sort of came to me rather than I went looking for it, which is part of the reason I think I got very injured. And I didn't have my mid-20s, I struggled a bit because I was very immature mentally. Mentally, I was still a kid. I just wanted to enjoy myself. I just wanted to make the most of what was in front of me on that day. And I never thought about the next day. I never thought about recovery. I just thought, I'd train for 2 hours and then I'd go home and I'd be like staying up till stupid o'clock and prattling around and not thinking about recovery for my session. And this went on for too long. Because I just really enjoyed friendships and life and other things. And I think when I was in 2008, I'd had lottery funding and I'd had a small, very small bit of funding from a clothing brand, and it was all ending. And I just got together with my now wife, Gemma, and I was living in Loughborough. So I graduated in 2004. In 2008, I spent those 4 years just being very immature and very injured a lot. And I'd had a lot of people put a lot of time and effort into me. And obviously in 2008, I was 27. So I was an older athlete at that point, and I was going to move home, and I was starting to do personal training. I was looking into jobs and doing other things. And Mark Rowland was coaching Gemma at the time. And he got offered a job in America at the OTC, Oregon Track Club. He was working for UK Athletics and he got offered a job out there. And he took it and he invited Gemma to go with him because all his other athletes were retiring after those games. And Gemma asked if I could go with her. And I, to this day, I don't know what would have happened but he said, yeah. And I went over there with a real... I didn't want to let Gemma down. I didn't want to let Mark down. And I on that plane ride, I was like, I need to grow up. I need to grow up now. And I just started to really... I still wasn't taking myself as, I didn't think I suddenly go, well, I can be this, that, and the other. I just took the process more seriously. I took the little things more seriously. And I put together a year without getting injured because I was looking after myself. And because Mark is such a good coach and I seized the opportunity. And I hadn't put together, the last time I had gone that long without being injured was 2004. So in 2004, I ran 13:24 for 5K when I was 23.
Wow.
And so I was young and I was running quick. And that's in old shoes as well.
Yeah.
Bear in mind. So I was young. And when I look back at my training that I ran 13:24, then I look back at my training and think, how? If I'd have known that, if I'd have looking back, if I could have just told myself, do you realize what you've just done and the training you've done to do that? Literally, good Lord. Like, I just did not realize what I'd done. I mean, I was overweight. It was a joke. So anyway, and I put together a year, and I was on it. I was meeting Mark in the middle with my, as Mark would always say, it's not the 2 hours I'm with you, it's the 22 hours I don't see you. Mm. That he says that's the thing that can really make or break an athlete. And I put a lot, and Gemma was already, she's 3 years younger than me. So I was 27, she was 24. And she was a lot more mature than me. So I fed off that massively. Like, I really, you know, nutritionally, everything was, she was a lot more in tune with herself, and she was reaping the rewards, and she was a lot more successful than I was. And I, with a lot more discipline, a lot more obsession, and suddenly I went from almost retiring to 27, 29 for 10K. And and I was like 13:11 or 13:10, whatever I ran. And it was like, it was waiting to happen. I was going about things all wrong in myself. I just was, this 23-year-old kid had shown potential, but I knew I was good. I just didn't realize how much of a difference it was making that I was self-destructing myself. I've had my ups and downs, but then the penny dropped and I started to get it a bit more, and I started to tune into a lot of what people were trying, you know, they were trying to help me and trying to look, and it kind of, the penny dropped of what I needed to do to help the situation. Because sometimes you know, I was turning up thinking, oh, give me the session, I'll smash it, I'll go home, that's all I need to do. I mean, that's how naive I was. And that's not good. It's, you know, I look back and I think, good, that's fine up until a certain age.
Mm.
But I wish at some point someone said, you could have a really good career and you could, that's what I'd go back and tell myself. Look, you could have a really great career and really do well, but you've got to start growing up. Because I don't want to say take myself seriously, because I did take myself seriously, but I just wasn't growing up. I was too immature. Yeah. But that's just the harsh reality of you know, we've all got something.
It's crazy to think you were that good with still that mentality almost, because most people, like, that mentality will switch and then they'll, you know, hit that sort of like 13:24 level that you hit, but you managed to get to that level with that mentality, which just shows almost like how talented you must have been.
Because
13:24 is no joke.
Yeah, I don't like to, like, label myself as, I don't, you know, it sounds, but I do. If I take myself out of it and I look and I saw, if I saw a kid do that and think, saw the training, I mean, I've looked back on my diary.
What was it? Give us some details.
Say again?
Give us some details if you can. Do you remember any?
It's in the move. I found it. So I've got bits and bobs. I need to look back at some of the things I did, but from what little I know, because I thought, I looked at it, I thought, well, that could be quite cool to post some of that, but I need to look back. But are things like, you know, from the gist I could see, it's like the kind of volume I was doing is like 5 or 6K on a track. Mm. You know, it's not huge volume. I certainly wasn't doing huge mileage, because that's just not how I operated. Mm. It's just, I was just too, yeah. And again, it falls into the trap of glamorizing it. It's not glamorizing it at all, because I worked hard. When I trained, I trained hard.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get me wrong, you know, I worked hard, but if plenty of athletes can testify that working hard is part of it, but you've also got to do the right thing, and it's got to be done in the right way. And I just had blinkers. I was a horse with blinkers, just like, but yeah, no, I need to go over it. So apologies. I can't give you detail, because I literally found it in the move and went, wow, this is going to be interesting to read through. So yeah, when I do, maybe I come back and I'll,
I think, yeah, if you do find it, you should post it, because people would love that. Absolutely love that.
No, it's interesting you say about how almost you kind of got that influence from Mark Rowland in terms of how the little things. I think when we had James Thee on the podcast, he said that that's the biggest thing he took from Mark Rowland's, from his kind of period with Mark Rowland, was just all the little things and how important they are in setting you up. Like, how kind of, what advice would you give to someone who might be kind of listening to this thinking, I'm in a similar position in terms of they kind of want to start doing those things. But it's, I guess it's easier said than done in terms of just flipping a switch, or was it the case of you just realizing, okay, I need to just flip the switch now?
I think, and I do this. I have done this with a couple of athletes I work with, is you can't sit an athlete down and just throw up information on them, because they'll just get covered in sick and just have to clean it off, and they've absorbed nothing. There is this process of drip feeding and getting the person in the right place to absorb it. And sometimes it's just, you know, when I bear in mind the little things, they really are the little things that should be being added to the big overall picture. So if you don't get the base of your pyramid right, and you're adding little things, they're not going to make any difference. So unless you get the base ready. And so for me, a lot of it is initially, you know, you got to get the right team people around you, and get that in a way that are you asking the right questions? Are you thinking in the right way? Because I think sometimes that I never, and again, I don't want to advocate questioning training. It's not that, because I never questioned anything. I just did it. I just blindly got on with it. But I think it's healthy to go to think about where you're trying to get to more. Mm. So if you're doing sessions, it's healthy to think about, where am I trying to get to over the next 2-3 years? What am I trying to build towards here? Because that can also include, you know, what's around you and what team you have around you. Are you speaking to enough people? If you're younger, don't, you know, a younger athlete, ask questions. You know, your coach and the people around you should be encouraging you to not look at things in a one-dimensional. There's no, it will be impossible for a 19, 20-year-old kid to have all the answers.
Yeah.
And even for the people around you, you know, if I was working with a 19-year-old kid, I don't have all the answers. It wouldn't be coming to me with all the answers. It would be, I would be some of the things that I could offer, and then there'll be someone else. And it's getting that rounded. Like, part of the reason that I feel like now I'm doing so well is because I've worked with four equally brilliant coaches in their own way.
It's interesting.
And I'm not saying you should work with, I'm not saying that in a, it's healthy to bounce around. That's not remotely what I'm saying. It's more a case of, a lot of the reason that happened, because it happened organically, because of my situation was changing and my life was changing, and it all happened organically. It wasn't I need to move on. It was just the organic nature. Like Mark and Alan, my now coach, I was moving back to from America. I wanted to do marathons, and Mark and Alan had a conversation, and I kind of, there was a kind of a handover through them and the way it works. It was all every step of the way, it's been very organic, but it's healthy to ask questions. And that's what I think there are get togethers. There are, you know, people, seminars and people having conversations and speak to older athletes. That was something I didn't do enough. I didn't reach out to older athletes enough. We're in a very lucky, you could argue lucky, could argue negative. Information is a lot easier to get hold of now with social media. But there is a negative to that because you can have too much. So there's a balance with it. It's very easy to athletes to fall into the trap of, I just need to know what the session is that's going to make me awesome. Well, that's not how it works. Why are you doing that session? What's the reason for it? Does it suit you? What kind of an athlete are you? You know, so it sounds very complicated, but it's not. It's a case of nudging people to kind of think more about what they're doing rather than, like I did, was just stick in the moment. And so when we talk about little things, you know, if I gave, let's say, talk nutrition for a sec, if I gave a little tip about nutrition, well, that doesn't help anyone. Nutrition is something that people should go away and learn about nutrition. What is good nutrition? Not a few tricks and things. Because quite often when you look up things, it's like, here's my top 10 tips. Mm. Well, that doesn't help you understand why you're doing what you're doing, does it? If I said to you, like, take a gel on in a marathon, well, that's obvious because everyone does it. But why do you do it? What's the reason? What's the mechanism behind it? You know, it's that kind of thought process. You know you're doing a session, why are you doing the session? It's not because it's a bad session, but why are you doing the session? How is it going to help you? What's the reason behind this? For that to help you and empower you. And there's plenty, and over here, I say over here because I don't know why I say over here, but here in the UK, there are lots of networks of athletes that, you know, do talk, and coaches that do talk, that everyone can have this nice kind of working together attitude. So, yeah, there's plenty of people out there that have a real desire to help and want to help athletes improve. But it has to come from the athlete as well, because, you know, if you're waiting for people to come to you, or you're not ready to absorb, or you're too, oh, I think I know everything. You're in trouble.
yeah, I'd agree with that. On that grounds, then, like, your coach at the moment, Alan Story, yeah?
Correct.
Just give us a little insight in, like, what the relationship's like, because obviously you've got heaps of experience. You probably know what works for you, but, you know, I feel like a lot of people at your sort of age and level of experience, they'll usually just coach themselves in a way. So how much impetus does Alan have on you? Is he very hands-on, or, like you say, do you just discuss it openly and just pretty much set it yourself, and he tells you whether you're in shape or not, almost?
We keep it simple, insofar as the communication around feedback and progression of thing, we're pretty in tune with each other and keep it simple. But I 100%, he writes the program, delivers it, and all that. And what I do, when he sets something, I'll sit there, not because I'm questioning it, but I'll sit there and use it as a tool for me to understand my own coaching by trying to understand why he set it, and understand his reasoning behind it. And so that's my little game I play with myself to go, okay, why has he done that? But he's even at my age, having someone else set it gives you
confidence
and clarity, and also that protection against overtraining yourself, because it's very difficult, I think, to go easy on yourself. There's always that guilt of, I should do more, and he's my control. He's my kind of safety net. And he 100%, I give himself completely to that, and it helps me. So I, my coaching mind and my session mind, I gear toward the athletes I work with, So I still keep that. I want to keep that part of my brain operating and still learn, but I don't do it with myself. I just completely entrust him. And then I use my thought process with the other athletes, which helps me kind of separate the two out. Because when you're training, I don't want to be training going, have I done the right, have I set myself? I just give myself, it's my way of keeping myself calm and in a rhythm, offloading that to him. It's a real massive help. But in terms of how we communicate afterwards, I mean, quite often I don't communicate times because he knows I know how to operate. I can give him very simple insights to how the session went. I mean, we will talk for over half an hour, and 2 or 3 minutes is about the session, and the rest of the time we're just putting the world to rights. And he's he's a friend first. He's a, I'd argue, a mentor second and a coach third. And he wouldn't take offense to that because they're all equally important. You know, without him as my coach, I would not be this successful. But just what he means to me as a person and what he has done for me goes way beyond coaching, And I can't thank him enough because I've known him since I first got into sport. He was the head coach of UK Athletics. Well, back then it was, I forget what it was called before. It's changed names 3 or 4 times, but whatever it was back then, he was the head of endurance. And so I've known him for a long time. He's known me for a long time and seen me. And he's been a massive reason why people have kept the faith with me. Right. Because him and Mark both worked for UKA, and they were part of the reason I kept lottery funding, because they were making decisions on athletes like myself, and they could see I had talent. I just needed to grow up. And it's kind of a real nice, sweet end to my career to think that these guys that kept the faith in me, that hopefully they feel like
they've done their job.
That, you know, well, that I've justified the fact they did that, you know, because it's really is. I mean, they put passion into the endurance sport. Mark and Alan have put their heart and soul into British distance running. I know Mark lives in America, but he worked for UKA. He still coaches British athletes. They've done so much for endurance and middle distance in this country, and the most successful coaches this country has seen. And I was part of being a kid, part of the reason I've kept going. And there's, you know, there's other people, but they have a massive part, and I feel very lucky to have had them, because as we know, like, without going off on a tangent, you know, we haven't seen that care and attention in quite the same way in the recent years, and I feel very lucky I had them too when I did, because it's a good chance I wouldn't have made it if I was born 10 years later. I probably would have disappeared. And so, I feel forever indebted to Alan and Mark, and they're just, they're special people.
Yeah, no, it's awesome to hear. I feel like anyone who reaches the level you've reached, there's always people in their corner like that.
Yeah, you need it.
Yeah.
You need it. People to get to selflessly do that, which is why that, you know, you've heard of the pay it forward thing. And it's, I'm trying. I want to do it more and stuff like that. But I think athletes, because again, it's the same thing. Mark will say, Mark Rowland used to say, match the level, match the level the athlete puts in. Yeah. And that's one of the things that working with Amelia Gareca, she pushed me hard to meet her level of enthusiasm. And that's what you want from an athlete. An athlete pushed the coach to work harder for you because of their commitment. And I mean, all I did when I was younger, I just encouraged my coaches to drink because that's all I deserve. But it's exactly that, you know, you push your support team to, you know, to match your level of enthusiasm and desire and drive to keep trying harder and want more. And,
yeah, no, It's it's great to see you kind of transitioning that kind of passion you had from your coaches into your own coaching now. Like, how are you finding all of the coaching and something you kind of looking for full time once you do hang up the shoes, if you like?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, there's a few. I've had quite a few different conversations, and there's a few different projects sort of coming forward. I mean, it's difficult. I think the tough thing with coaching is you've obviously got to prove yourself, and that takes time. And I think at the moment I've done bits and bobs, but I think my coaching pathway is going to need to keep organically growing through me gaining more and more experience and hopefully working with more athletes and having success through them for me to, you know, because there's no guarantees that, you know, that I would just be a coach like to the standard of Mark and Alan. I mean, the chances of that are highly unlikely, really, when they are such an anomaly. But yeah, you know, there's a few things going on, but certainly in terms of whether I end up being a full-time coach or anything like that is, you know, not only would that take time to be good enough to do that, it would also take a bit of luck because there's not exactly many paid coaching roles in this country. Yeah. But at the moment, I keep trying to improve, keep trying to get better, but I will still need to make a living in other ways until that may or may not materialize. I really don't know, but it's certainly if it's something I do as a side passion alongside another career, then that's fine. I'll always want to stay involved in athletics in some way, but and try and offer as much of my experience as I can. But again, like, I don't think at the moment I can't do much more partly because I'm an athlete and partly because I'm, you know, there's a lot of moves, spinning plates going on at the moment that I'm trying to explore. But and even if I stopped my running tomorrow, I couldn't just walk into a coaching position because I've just not got enough experience. I need to work on it a lot. You know, I need a lot more coaching hours under my belt and different athletes, because so many athletes are different. I mean, the chance of me coaching anyone that's like me is unlikely, not because I'm a rare talent. It's because it's very rare to have two athletes the same.
Yeah, I agree.
Athletes aren't the same. Athletes are very individual. And the better they get, the more individual they get, which is a nightmare.
Yeah. I mean, it's great to see you kind of have that attitude, to be honest, because I think there's a lot of, particularly in other sports as well, there's a lot of kind of presumptions made about being able to go into coaching based purely off your own individual career. So I think, yes, great to see you have that kind of attitude about learning as well, rather than just presuming you've got it all because you've done it yourself.
Well, it's ironically, it's in a lot of ways you could argue athletes, like for a lot of time, athletes have had very one-dimensional view of coaching because it's themselves. So, you know, sometimes it's almost like with football, that it seems like the most successful players that go on to be managers are ones that played very much roles in sort of almost midfield roles. That were very their involvement in the game was very tactical, so they had a much more of an open view of the game.
Yeah,
so that kind of fed into their coaching because they had a very overview kind of seeing rather than a goalkeeper. So I can't think of a goalkeeper that's gone into management. I could be wrong, but and so for me, you know, I've got a particular set of skills which has to be broadened. You know, I think that's, you know, my biggest asset in terms of coaching would be the fact when I was OTC and seeing Gemma and seeing other things, but that doesn't give you instant, I can't click yet. Yeah. My hand's still not right there.
Still not right.
No, God, no. It's still a bit wonky. I think it's fascinating. I mean, if I do find coaching fascinating because the level in which you could take it, you could really get yourself in a tizz and just the level of detail you could go to. And I love that thought, but you know, that takes years. I mean, crikey, if you tap into Alan Story's journey through coaching, I don't know if anyone would want to start, because it's insane. Like, because bear in mind, back then when he didn't have internet, he was going to a library and reading books, and
wow,
you know it takes you a long time to gather the kind of information you can gather now. A long time.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Look, Tomo, we've got a quick Q&A for you. A few fun questions.
No worries. Sorry, I've taken up loads of your time. Have I got the record yet?
I think so. But yeah. We always like someone who can talk, because it just makes our job easier. So, right, yeah.
You should have just pressed record and then buggered off.
I think we got a fun question here. I kind of want to know the answer to it, but
go on, then.
We want to know about the time you threw your Adidas trainers out the window at uni.
Who asked that out of interest?
I don't know. Could I say Ollie Laws?
Okay. Right. I was gonna say Ollie loves that story. Okay, that's there you go. So I was at Loughborough Uni, and I had, to that point, I'd only ever had twisted my ankle. Was about the biggest drama I had with injuries.
Right.
And I it was funny, because there was a load of us in Butler Corps, and there was a few, quite a few athletes in the thing. So we all came together, and there was Fila, Irish athletes responsible by Fila, and there was added, anyway. So we get a kit drop, and it was about a couple of weeks after we got this kit drop and run these shoes, and I got a stress fracture in my third metatarsal, and I just threw a wobbly, thinking it was these shoes. It was the shoes' fault, like the kind of irrational, immature kind of person I was. I was just like, it had nothing to do with my diet, nothing to do with the fact I had probably was getting no calcium in my diet, and I just looked to blame someone else. So I decided to take my frustration out on these shoes. I got a knife, cut them all up, and threw them out the window. I mean, I think I'd done about two runs in them. Seriously, I'd done about two runs in them, and I was convinced that was it. And it was that was the level I was when I was a child. I think yeah. And then I went off to Matt's bar or something to have a few drinks.
Oh gosh. Look, someone's asked, they're 28, they started running 5 years ago.
Yeah.
They want to run a sub 30 minute 10K.
Yeah.
They're at 32 minutes now, but they want to ask if they're too old.
God, no. No, yeah. No. That's I mean, so I ran my 10K PB when I was 31, I think it was 30 or 31. And I think, and don't forget, I ran a 37, I think it was. I ran 27:52. Highgate, yeah. And I think I could have run quick. I mean, 27:27 to my PB. And I ran that when I was 30, 31, and I could have, in the years, if I hadn't got injured, I think I could have run quicker later in my career. So absolutely not. So in a nutshell, I think running and age is like, it's like a car. So if you've got a car that's been sat in your drive for 5 years and got like 10 miles, it's still going to act like a new car, because it's not got many miles. But if you put a few miles in it in the first few, it's generally the miles in the car rather than the age of it, is my kind of mentality. But again, alongside that, if you've got 100,000 miles on a car, but you've MOT'd it every year, you've looked after it, you serviced it, it's going to give it a longer shelf life. Yeah. So no, definitely not. At 28, you're still a baby. Anyone that says starts with a 2, I'm like, you're a baby. As long as you're not 200, that might be different. Start with a 2, you're a baby. Athletically, yeah, you're a baby.
Of all the variables, what do you credit for the, like, which one do you credit the most for your longevity in your career?
If you
can pin it down to one.
The what, sorry?
I said, if you can even pin it down to one variable.
No, I definitely can't. I think there's a few things. I think, stubbornness, wising up a little bit. Listening to my body a lot has been a huge one. Listening to my body, like I've, I don't train like I did when I was 25. Well, I didn't train when I was 25 because I was injured. But when I was younger, I don't train. I've adapted things. So like mileage is not a target anymore. You know, it's I run to the limit of what my body can do. I don't set training as targets. I set sessions around my health. I work around my health rather than my fitness. I also think another thing that has made a bit of a difference is that I had, from the age of 24, I've only had 2 full summers. Wow. And that, I think that makes a difference in terms of intensity, because track can be very intense, especially for middle distance guys, just going from race to race. It's exhausting. I mean, Gemma, my wife, was an 800 meter runner, and she'd get to September and her face just looked like she needed 3 months off. She was exhausted. Because one of the greatest things my wife did, that she ran. So she had, it was 2011, and the qualifying time for the 2011, yeah, qualifying time for the Olympics was like 159.9 or 159.8 or something, whatever it was. She didn't have a time. So there weren't many races left at the end of the season, and because she'd had a hamstring tear. So they found a race in, I'd have to check with her where it was, but it was in one country, in somewhere in Europe. There was a race on one day and then a day off and then another race in another country. Mm. She went to this race, ran, and back then for 2012, you needed 2 A standards.
Yeah. Oh God, man,
she got the A standard, 159 something at this race. The next day traveled to the next race and then the next day run 159 and got the A standard and came home. And honestly, before she left, she looked exhausted. I was like, well, and she came back after, like, because that's the kind of stuff middle distance people do. It's crazy. Yeah. But I only had 2 full summers in my career. And I think the fact my body didn't go through that intensity too often. And so would have half summers and half that I'd dip my toe in, but then injuries. And I think that helped as well. But definitely working around my health rather than fitness has made a big difference.
Yeah, that's a good point. Look, is access to a sports psychologist something readily available for you? Do you use it at all?
It was when I was on lottery, back when I was on lottery funding, but I never properly delved into it, although I think it would have been useful for me.
Mm.
But I think I think I should have tapped into it more to help me kind of wise up a little bit. But yeah, I think the biggest psychological lesson I had was when I went out to America and I suddenly felt very responsible and very, I started to take responsibility for myself. And that was the lesson I needed from a psychologist. And it was that whole experience of going out there and feeling there wasn't like an arm to put around me anymore. There was no safety net. It was that was enough of a tonic for me. So I haven't done. But yeah, I think if I was young, when I was younger, I think I possibly should have done. And again, that's part of my own fault. You know, I can't, they're not going to come to me. I've got to go to them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like psychologists, like, maybe I know a couple, you know, elite athletes now who use them, but it's not something distance runners tend to use massively, is it?
I don't know. I think I don't know this, but I can't. It's some people, like someone like Jess Ennis and Mo at 2012. How did they cope with that?
Yeah.
I mean, they must have spoken to someone. I think it's something that people, I think. The problem is that I think psychologists gets associated with a certain type of stigma, but sometimes it's not necessarily a weakness. It's just a way of managing emotion and managing your routine as well. It's a part, and that, And that is actually what I needed. And yeah. I think even like race management, people think of probably psychology, well, how do you manage race day? Well, that's a very small part of the whole psychological. I mean, the biggest issue is the weeks and months leading into a race and how you manage towing that line of injury and illness. Yeah. So, yeah, I think it's something that when you look at someone like Ronnie O'Sullivan, who uses that Steve Peters religiously, I think, to help him, and he's really helped his career sort of be prolonged.
Carry on.
I think sometimes it's one of those things that, psychology goes beyond just helping you win a race. There's more to it than that. And that's, I think, but again, it's a mentor for me, like that's what kind of what Alan is. He's a bit of a mentor and helps me structure my life. So in a way, he probably acts as a bit of a psychologist for me in a lot of ways.
That's interesting. Yeah. Well, we'll probably wrap it up, but mate, we could have you on all day. Mate, I think you should go into motivational speaking something like that, because your career is so like up and down. You've got so many lessons for people to learn. So you should seriously think about that.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. Well, it's can you hear him? There comes Theo. He's upstairs for his nappy change. It's funny because I over allocate. I get my friends joke that I take a long time to say not a lot. So I need to refine the way I nutshell things and talk about things. But my brain is always like 5 meters ahead of my legs or my mouth, should I say. That means I'm constantly going round in circles a little bit. So I run round in circles and I talk round in circles. So I apologize. But yeah, I'm thank you very much is my point. I've done it then. I should have just said thank you and left it, but I just went off on one.
No, but you're just so comfortable talking. Yeah, it's been brilliant to have you on though, mate. Cheers.
No worries. Thanks for having me on, boys.
Thanks for listening, guys. We hope you enjoyed this week's podcast. As always, if you did, please leave us a rating and a review on your preferred podcast streaming service. We're also pleased to announce that next week's guest, we've got Phil Sesman. Phil's been a very requested guest amongst some of you guys, so I hope you're looking forward to listening to him. We enjoyed recording it. Cheers, guys. See you next week.